Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Christina McMorris. I'm the author of Letters from Home, and my new release is Bridge of Scarlet Leaves. And I am super excited to be talking to my friend Alma Katsu today, who is the incredible author. She's, even if we were not friends, I would say this, she is actually one of my all-time favorite authors of the novel The Taker, which was her debut novel. So, hi, Alma.
Hi, Chris. Oh, you are too kind. Too kind.
Well, you know, I drool over your book, so it's the best thing ever, isn't it, when you have an author friend and you genuinely really, really love their book and you want to tell the whole world. It makes it so much easier to be proud.
Well, that's how I feel about Bridge of Scarlet Leaves. I just loved it, and as we're going to get into, because there's this personal connection, and I think you just did such an incredible job with this novel.
Oh, thank you, and God, you know, from you, that means so much. So I appreciate that. Wanted to go ahead and why don't we tell listeners, who I'm sure a lot of people know about your book already, which I'm thrilled about, and I've been spreading word to all my book clubs over here too, but why don't you tell people a little bit about your book and what you're working on now, and then we'll maybe get into our own personal connections.
Sure. Well, it's funny in a way. I mean, what we write is so dissimilar. You know, you write these great historical, you know, romantic stories, and I write, you know, these sort of funny, not funny, they're very dark, but historical supernatural books. You know, they've been compared a lot to early Anne Rice, like Interview with a Vampire, but with its own sort of supernatural myth. It doesn't have vampires or werewolves or anything like that. So, in a way, very dissimilar, but we do both write historical.
Yeah, and I think we have a lot of similarities, too, that when I started thinking about knowing that we were going to be talking today, I started thinking about the fact that because your books, I know, really revolve around immortals. So I know that's, you know, a big difference, of course, from the vampire, the sucking blood, the, you know, thank God, you know, no zombies in yours. I really like when everybody keeps their body parts. and so with yours, I loved that, you know, I started thinking about how we are. Our books are very different. We have the historical feel, but at the same time, I thought, you know, over the weekend, I was thinking, you know what's kind of cool? I think maybe there was something that I loved so much about your book. I couldn't really. I have such a short attention span, and with two little kids, I have a 6- and 8-year-old, and so my time is limited when I actually have the energy to keep turning pages before I fall asleep. And with yours, for 2 days, I read your book, which is like lightning speed for me, because I read like a sloth, and I could not put that book down. We were away on a vacation, and so I was supposed to, I'm sure, be spending time with my family, but I'll blame you, because every chance I got, they said, oh, I have to go run to the restroom. I'm thinking, okay, good, I have at least good 10 minutes, and
oh my gosh.
I took it to the pool. I took it into the hot tub. I didn't want to be away from it. It's sort of addictive. I think you've like woven in some hemp or something crazy into the pages, because I didn't want to put it down. And I think looking back at it, I usually don't read paranormals. And I think that's really important to state, because they're, I think this book goes so far beyond that. And I normally would not pick up a book that had paranormal element to it. Just not usually something I read, but I think what I was so drawn to was the fact that it is similar in books I love, that it's a love that you cannot have. It's, you know, it's kind of that impossible love story, and I think that can be true with historicals or World War II or, you know, a lot of the things I usually read.
Right. Well, you know, that's very nice of you, by the way. That was very, very kind of you. The nice thing about when you write a little bit with supernatural and that sort of thing, is that you get to push some of the boundaries that writers like you have to obey. So, you know, when I sat down and I said I wanted to write this book, I wanted to write something that would just sweep readers away. You know, I wanted to see if I could write a story that had characters that you just couldn't stop thinking about, and a story that just, you know, was bigger than life. And so I thought, you know, what about a love that just transcends time, that, you know, you just can't deny. So that's what I tried to do, with no intention of ever being published. I never thought this story would be published, but, you know, I was really lucky and had a happy ending.
Yeah, in such a big way, too. And so, and you're writing a series of, it's a series of three, correct? That's where you're ending it, is with three?
Yes. The second book comes out in June, and I'm working on the third book now, which is the most magical of the three books, and everything's wrapped up in all of the, you know, you get all the answers. Where is the magic coming from, and what's really going on here in book three? So hopefully people can, put up with the aggravation of not knowing in the first
That's so funny. That'll be great. I didn't know you were going to do that with the third. And, you know, what's so funny is I'm sure that people, there probably are some people who are very logical that want to know why, you know. But for me, I just accepted that it was immortality and there was some magic involved. And I don't know, there were so many things that were grounded in reality that I think I just accepted that. And I went along for the ride. So
you're
that's funny.
You're an ideal reader.
Yeah.
But let's talk about your book, because I'm so dying to talk about Bridget Scarlet Leaf. I've been dying for people to read it so I can talk about it.
Oh, you're so sweet. I know we haven't got a chance. Last time I saw you, I got to hand off my advanced copy. So we finally, aside from emails, get to finally chat together, which is so exciting. Because as people may or may not know, Alma and I have a lot in common as far as our families go, which is why I was so excited to hand over that copy. She and I are both half Japanese, and she's married, right? You're married to half Japanese.
Right, and we're like little bookends, we match.
Right, you're salt and pepper shakers at a sushi bar. So, we're both half Japanese, and it's so funny, and I know Alma knows this, my dad, because my dad is an immigrant from Kyoto, although we're not Hawaiian, and it's a Hawaiian term, technically, my dad always raised us calling us hapas, because hapa means half in Hawaiian, and so I swear, I have this, I don't know about you, Alma, but I have like a hapa radar, so if I... It's like a hapadar. And so if I see someone like across a room in a store or what have you, it's good when you ask on the West Coast, because typically West Coast people know the term hapas. We're more familiar with that than, you know, since we're closer to Hawaii. But I'll ask someone, are you a hapa? You know, and you always hope that they understand the question. And typically, you know, they're kind of excited because we do have sort of this little, like this bond that we sort of understand being raised in both cultures and between two worlds, I think. So.
Yeah, that's exactly like that. It was a little bit rarer when I was young and growing up. As a matter of fact, I grew up in a very small town in Massachusetts, not in a rural part of Massachusetts, but you would have thought we were from another planet. When I was little, we were the Oriental family in town. My mom was the only full-blooded Oriental, but we were the Oriental family. There was one black family and one Jewish family. It was very funny, but now it's more common. So, when I met my husband and I found out he was half Japanese, I thought that was just, you know, he's like an alien, you know?
I know, there's more of us. You're like Spock and finding one more person on the planet that wasn't destroyed.
Right. Well, the other thing that was funny is my husband, he's one of the few that did not also marry a Japanese-American. So he, most of his family look full-blooded Japanese, and he doesn't. He looks more Asian than I do. I don't look Asian at all. I really got shortchanged. Yeah. But so the interesting thing is my mom came from Japan. She married my father after World War II and came over. And so I had grown up with her stories. Now, I didn't really hear a lot about the internment until I married, because my husband's father is Japanese-American. He was second generation, and he's one of seven children, and he and all of his brothers and sisters were interned. And so, you know, I had heard so many stories from them, although reluctantly, and that's something I wanted to talk to you about, too, just how hard it is sometimes to get that generation to talk about their experiences. But I heard about it, and we were so interested. For a while, my husband and I went on this binge of watching every documentary we could get our hands on the internment and reading books. And it's such a complex period that I think unless you get into it, you don't know. So that was one of the things I was so excited about with your book. And I'm reading it and it's like, yes, oh, and she brought this point up and she brought that point up. It was such a complicated time for them. And you did such a great job with your research that you incorporated all that in a very natural way. So you never felt like you were getting a history lesson, you know? How did you take such so much information, I'm sure, and just make it work? Did you have to do a lot of pruning, or you know, a lot of index cards to
organize
things in advance.
I know, you would think I'd have like a million post-its up or something like I did with my first novel, Letters from Home. But in this case, no, you know, I think I went ahead and I'm a plotter. I used to be an event planner, you know, and so plotting comes very, very naturally to me. But also because World War II is so huge in scope as far as research goes, that if I didn't narrow it down with plotting, then, you know, it would take me, you know, 10 years to research everything if I didn't know exactly, you know, the time frame I'm looking at and what theater we're talking about, that we're looking at the Pacific, for example, at during these years and kind of these units. So I did, you know, I sat down and I did plot. But when I say I'm a plotter, you know, there's a huge range, of course, of plotters. And I am one who, because I alternate points of view between always, you know, 3 to 4 characters, and I always like to keep that constantly rotating, consistently, I write one sentence per chapter. And so I'll be curious later to hear what your process is. But I write one sentence per chapter that really then assures me as a writer that that chapter needs to be there, you know, that it's not fluff, that there's a purpose. And then from there, you know, a lot of it was I researched for about 5 months before I wrote the book. So I had a lot of time to have it, let it simmer. And when I came across amazing points about, you know, the fact that, and I guess I should, you know, summarize in case people are unaware what my book is about, the fact that there were roughly 200 non-Japanese spouses living in what we know today, most people know as internment camps or relocation camps during World War II. When I came across that nugget, you know, I had set out to write a story really about two brothers, one who fought for America and the other for Japan. And that's a true account that often happens, more than people, you know about because they didn't talk about it. But there was also a family friend that did that. And so I had stored that information away long before I became a creative writer. And then I revisit the idea, and I started researching for that story, came across that one obscure mention about non-Japanese spouses, which, you know, if you think about it, it's one of those aha, like duh moments when you share it with someone. And for me myself, thinking, well, of course there would be. I hadn't even occurred to me before. But what would you do if you had a child? You know, you wouldn't send that child off. And so some of those people, especially the wives, because husbands often would have to stay back in case they were drafted. Many wives did follow and stay there. But again, you won't hear about those stories, really. And it was very hard to even find their names for me to research much about them. But I did come across that story. And then in my book, you know, I've got this woman named Maddie who's a violinist. She secretly elopes with her Japanese-American boyfriend the night before Pearl Harbor is bombed, and then follows him into the camp when his family is interned. And then the only other major element I'll mention, which gets back to your point about my research, is that her husband, wanting to prove his allegiance to America, which so many of them did because they were American, just because, you know, the color of their skin, black hair, you know, almond-shaped eyes makes them stand out from a crowd, they still felt a lot of, you know, in general, allegiance to America. And he joins the Military Intelligence Service, which was a secret branch of the U.S. Army responsible for code-breaking and interrogating it against Japan. So he essentially serves in the Pacific with a Marines unit where he could be shot by either side. So I just, when I came across that mention also, that was, you know, by mistake. I didn't even know about the Military Intelligence Service. They were classified, which I know from your, you know, CIA background, personally, you know, that just then so many things get hidden and buried, and nobody came to their door and knocked. And they literally told me when I interviewed 6 of them in LA, had said, nobody showed up and said, you can talk about it now. So we just didn't talk about it. And sadly, their accomplishments are, you know, are being lost, and people know more about guys that were in their units that were like Navajo code talkers because of the movie, The Wind Talkers. You know, I think Hollywood brings a lot of that to the forefront. But whenever I came across something like that, you know, I thought, this, I've got to find a way to put this in the story. And I was able, I think from what I remember, to put almost everything I wanted in the story somehow, that I thought, people need to know about this. You know, this is an incredible history lesson that hopefully I get to share some of that story with them through a fictional account, maybe people that usually wouldn't pick up a textbook, you know, I wouldn't, you know, but I'd pick up a novel, and hopefully, you know, people realize it is well-researched to the best of my ability and be able to learn along the way.
Well, I think you did an incredible job with the research. Now, the first story that you talked about two brothers who end up fighting on opposite sides, I mean, that alone would be a great story. But I agree when you found out about very obscure, because I had never heard about any American spouses, you know, Caucasian spouses following their spouses into the camps. Hadn't heard about that at all. So that is a remarkable story, and you did such a wonderful job with it. I mean, really, just fabulous. Now, the part about the military intelligence, I had heard a little bit, about that from two sources, but one was a documentary. There actually had been a documentary where part of it, they talked about how they went, after a while in the war, they went and they were recruiting right out of the camps to get these guys. And you know, when I talked to my father-in-law, that's the part that just blew me away, because at that time I had been working for the government for I don't know, at least 10 years. Yeah, I have a 30-year career that just ended recently in intelligence. I worked for the National Security Agency and for CIA. And, you know, I'm very patriotic. Right? I would not have spent 30 years working for the government.
Right.
But the thought of your government putting you in a camp, you know, just on the suspicion, I mean, I don't think people can imagine today the U.S. Government doing something like that. I know after 9/11 there was, you know, this sort of ripple of talk and, you know, that sort of backlash against Arab Americans, but it quickly, you know, was squashed. No one would seriously consider anything like that. But imagine that it did happen, you know, what was it, 60, 70 years ago, whatever. My math's not too good.
Yeah,
but,
you're right. Yeah, exactly, you know, 70 years, just a few weeks ago. Yeah.
And I talked to my father-in-law at the time. I talked to some of the other folks. And the feeling, I mean, there was, which you capture in the book, there were people who were indignant. There were people who felt that this was not justice. But by and large, just if you can imagine that many people voluntarily going into the camps because they want to prove that they're good Americans and they're loyal Americans. And then, as if that's not enough, they go off to war where exactly they face that situation where it's, you know, they're putting their lives on the line because either side could shoot them at this point. You know, they... It was just an incredible situation. So then I actually got to meet a few of the guys, a few Japanese-American guys who had been working for military intelligence and doing exactly the job that you have Lane in the book doing. They were retiring just as I was coming in, but it was such a privilege to meet these guys. And to a man, they were all so humble about, you know, what they had done and their bravery. So I'm really curious, how did you find survivors, you know, got people who were in the camps or were in the service. How did you track down these people? Because there's not that many left anymore.
No, it's true. It's true. And there's even fewer left that were kind of more active combat, you know, or you know, in that situation where they were on front lines or, you know, traveling really actively during the war, because it's more common for me to be able to find MIS who served more in occupied Japan after the war, because they're a little bit, they're a couple of years younger. But what happened, I was spoiled. Thank goodness, you know, there's always downsides of the internet, but I tell you, you know, being able to find resources, as you know, to speak to somebody, that came in very handy. I was doing some searches for research, asking, looking for answers from some of my questions, and I came across one website called Go for Broke Foundation, and they are located in Torrance, California. All they do, it's incredible, is focus on fundraising to kind of, how would you say it, kind of gather volunteers together who are all Japanese-American veterans who are willing to go out and speak at educational events and libraries and schools. So they want the history passed along, and that's what they do. I couldn't have found a more perfect organization, so I contacted them looking for answers to some of my questions. What they came back with was, if you ever in our area, would you like to have interviews? We'll set up as many as you'd like. So that was like a kid in a candy store. I'm like, what time does the next flight leave, basically? And I did travel down there, and I thought they were going to set up, you know, maybe two or three interviews. They said, we've set up seven. If you want more, let us know. And so, again, you know, these are guys who are with a foundation, who want to speak about it. They are there to educate people. So, you know, I'm sure this is not always the case. I was very lucky that I got to sit down with guys who wanted to tell their stories. And when you come back to the question you asked me earlier about what I was and wasn't able to put into the story, this is a perfect example. I sat down and interviewed one of them, and he was telling me a story about how he had some brothers who fought for Japan. He had also some brothers who fought for the U.S., and he personally was stationed in the Pacific. His unit one night was shooting down Japanese fighter planes, and he found out months later one of them was his brother. They killed all of those pilots. And it was a very brief mention. He got a little emotional, and then he moved on to the next story and was very humble about it and quiet about it and just moved on. That, of course, I couldn't put into the book. There's no way. For the obvious reason, nobody would believe me. That sounds so coincidental, and of course, stranger than fiction is life. And the good news is I got to put that in my author's note, you know, so it's like my deleted scenes. And I got to mention that. But, you know, it's amazing, and I'm sure you come across the same thing when you're researching history, and you find out things that you think, how did people not know about this?
I haven't come up, well, maybe because it's so personal to me. I mean, I think the things that you've uncovered are just phenomenal. Yeah. You know, the things I deal with are, you know, 200 years old or 500 years old. It's just not the same. So, and, you know, of course, I never get to interview someone. Actually.
Right. But we hope not.
Yeah, we hope not. So when and I was thinking about how did Chris do the research, I thought, what it must have been like to sit there and interview those guys. Now, of course, my father-in-law, talking to him, there was this emotional component. And, you know, I was finding that when I talked to the family members who had been in the camps, a lot of times they didn't want to talk about it. They were embarrassed. Yeah. They were embarrassed to have been treated like that. I mean, my father, I had to interview him once for Asia Pacific Month or something at work. They had asked me to write an article about his experience during World War II. And that was the first time I got to sit down and really interview him in depth. And that was the first time I found out, which you would put in your book, that, you know, the U.S. government was so rushed about doing this, they ended up putting them in the horse racing barns at the racetrack in San Francisco before the camps were actually ready. And, you know, he told me about that experience, and I could just see him get red with embarrassment and his eyes fill up with tears at admitting this to his daughter-in-law, that he had been kept in a horse barn, you know, when he was describing the conditions. And it just made me so mad that, you know, this government could treat its citizens like that. But it's just an incredible situation. And, you know, again, when you think back to 9/11, it's not something that's buried in the history books. It's definitely something that can come back at any time and make you wonder, should we treat some of our own citizens this way? And I hope that what the Japanese Americans went through will serve for Americans, you know, to show that, no, that's an extreme we don't need to go to, and that really changes our national character to do something like that.
Yeah, you definitely hope so. And I know one thing that I was really proud of, too, that I know you know from reading my book, that, you know, I think it's hard for us to imagine. I think that it's such a massive, large concept when we think of 120,000 people evacuated from the West Coast, you know, given 48 hours to a week at the most to get rid of everything they own, to only bring what you can carry, and that could be your child on top of it. So when you have a mother that has a baby, you've got one hand. So I think that the concept is so big that it ends up taking up and so often takes up, you know, two paragraphs in a history textbook in high school. And that's really what most people learn. And so it's just like, you know, the Holocaust. And I think unless we see movies and pictures and hear firsthand accounts, you don't really understand the impact of even that. And so for me, what I tried to do in my story anyway was finding those little stories, the small things that I think are so much more impactful and hurtful than that massive, you know, idea of moving everyone away. Instead, it was little things like, you know, being in a restaurant and having that you've grown up your whole life, that you know everyone on a first name basis who works there. You have your usual thing that you order every single time, and they ask you to leave. You know, that you can't order there anymore, or trying to move voluntarily from the West Coast before the camps, which people were allowed to do. They were given a window of time; they could do that. However, what often happened was they would get to a border of a state and people would either be standing there, because at the time, you imagine there weren't that many freeways or ways to get, say, to Nevada.
Right.
And have people standing there at the border telling you to turn back around, that they were not going to be California's dumping ground and to go back home. Or they would not sell them gas. And when you can't buy gas, what can you do? You're in the middle of the desert. So those stories to me were incredible. Also, one more actually that I rarely mention that I just remembered was even when the evacuation was happening and people are trying to sell off their belongings as fast as possible, vultures, junk dealers would show up at their door, knock on the door and tell them that basically they're going to be evacuated soon. They'll give them 5 cents on the dollar for everything they own. And there were even people that would walk into their houses late at night or in the middle of the day and walk out with things. They would literally come in and just rob them, because what were they going to do? They were not going to call the cops, and they knew it.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I think you did, that's what I mean, you did such a marvelous job at just picking up all these stories that really show the full scope of the impact on people's lives that I think any reader can relate to. And I didn't want to bring this up, but that's exactly what my in-laws' family went through. And the thing is, they were successful farmers. They had land in outside of San Francisco, and they had their own florist shop. The land they owned was extremely, worth a lot of money. They lost everything. They lost entire family fortune. People, Caucasian farmers snatched up that property and, bought their trucks and things like that for literally pennies on the dollar. And, people aren't aware of that. It's just phenomenal. And then to think that these people don't bear a grudge against the government is just phenomenal. I just couldn't believe that.
Yeah, you're right. I think there's a lot of, like you said, about the shame coming out of the camps. I think there was also, because on the flip side, I left those vets interviewing them and then went to on a pilgrimage at Manzanar relocation camp and met a lot of survivors that lived that there or at another camp. And again, like you said, the older generation didn't want to talk about it. The younger ones who were kids there loved to talk about it because their memories as a child were very different, because the perspective, is everything. And viewing it as a fun camp that they got to run around with friends was very different from we lost everything. And, What were you going to say?
Well, that's my father-in-law was a teenager when he was sent to the camps. And he, just like your characters, were able to leave the camps. The family sponsored them so he could go to high school. And the other thing that helped sway it was his brother-in-law, one of his sister's husbands, ended up going to work for the government, in military intelligence, and he helped influence. So he was able to get John out of the camp. And you talk to John, and he just always has these such happy memories of him. And I hate to do this to him, but if you peel back the corner of that memory, then you see the really sad, painful things that did happen that they just kind of try to blank out of their memory.
Right. And I think you're exactly what we're saying, and this is not just about the Japanese American internment, but I think what you said is so true about so many survivors of wartime, and even today. I think that's what makes, I'm hopeful that it makes it relevant today, too. We've got so many multicultural relationships and marriages and bicultural children, but then also wartime, that is still relevant today of people. Veterans who are going away to war several tours at a time and coming back and supposed to, like World War II vet or survivor of any kind of relocation camp or concentration camp, kind of being pushed back into society and supposed to act like nothing happened, and go back and start and take your job and raise your children and pretend it didn't happen.
Yes, very, very Yeah, it's still very pertinent today. I have a feeling we're starting to run out of time. Is that the case?
We are. I just looked at the time, and we have about 1 minute. So I told you we could fill this with no problem whatsoever.
Well, like I said, I cannot impress upon people enough that they really should read the book. Not only is it just super enjoyable, but it just tells such an important part of history so well. And just all in all, it's just a super book. So congratulations, Chris. When you told me about it, I was excited about it. But now that I've read it, I'm even more excited about it. I'm excited about the next one, too. I can't wait to
read it. Thank you. Thank you. I cannot wait to, oh my gosh, I can't wait to read your second one. Holy cow, I can't wait till June. So we will wrap up now, and this was so much fun. This is not a day at work at all. This is just pure fun. So our websites, in case you want to hear more, because clearly we have much more to say, my website is www.christina.mcmorris. It's mcmorris.com. And Alma, yours?
I'll spell it because no one can get my name. It's www.almakatsu.com. Yes, it's like the most unusual name in the world, I think.
I know, but I love it, and it's memorable, just like your books. So it fits perfectly.
Well, thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you so much, and I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, we got to get together.
Bye-bye. Good. Bye.
Around me turned to gold. I thought I had everything. Now I'm left without a hand to hold. But it's alright, I'm okay. How are you? For what it's worth, I must say I love. And in my bed, late at night, I miss you. Someone is gonna save my heart. No one is gonna break my heart again. I used to be a king. Everything around me turned to rust. It's 'cause I built my life on sand. And I watched it crumble in the dust. Yeah, but it's alright, I'm okay. I wanna know how you are. And what is everything around me turned around. But I know all I have to do is sing. And I lift myself way up.